Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hail More, A Soldier Once and Always, by Mike Guardia. Narrated by Johnny Heller. Introduction. Let us understand the situation. We are going into battle against a tough and determined enemy. I can't promise you that I will bring you all home alive, but this I swear, before you and before Almighty God, that when we go into battle, I will be the first one to set foot on the field, and I will be the last to step off, and I will leave no one behind. Dead or alive, we will all come home together. So help me God. That was the promise made by Lieutenant Colonel Harold G. Hale Moore to the men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, on the eve of their deployment to Vietnam. On the morning of November 14th, 1965, Hale Moore led the 400-man battalion against two North Vietnamese Army, NVA regiments, at the Battle of Ya Dreng, one of the first major battles of the Vietnam War. Outnumbered 4-1, Lieutenant Colonel Moore led his battalion to a surprising victory, which claimed the lives of over 1,200 enemy soldiers. 79 Americans died in the engagement. The Battle of Ya Dreng pioneered the use of air mobile infantry, delivering troops into battle via helicopter. Moore himself had played a key role in developing air mobility tactics during the early 1960s. Together with journalist Joseph L. Galloway, he later wrote about his experiences at Ya Dreng in the critically acclaimed book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, which Paramount Pictures later adapted into the film We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson. A 1945 West Point graduate, Moore's military career began as World War II ended. After serving a 3-year tour with the 11th Airborne Division in occupied Japan, Moore returned to the United States and then served in the Korean War. As a young captain, he fought in the battles of Old Baldy, T-Bone, and Porkchop Hill. Following his subsequent year-long tour in Vietnam, Moore commanded the 7th Infantry Division, forward stationed in South Korea. At the time, the U.S. 7th Division, like most units in the Army, suffered from race riots, illegal drug use, and gang violence. To correct these problems, Moore relieved a number of key leaders within the division and initiated a new program of training and discipline. By the end of his tenure, the division's disciplinary problems had virtually disappeared, and combat readiness surged to an all-time high. Returning stateside in 1971, he assumed command of the Army Training Center at Fort Ord, California. In his capacity, he oversaw the development of several training programs for Project Volar, Volunteer Army, the U.S. Army's transition from a conscript-based force to an all-volunteer force. He retired as a lieutenant general in 1977. Like most of my fellow millennials, those born after 1980, my introduction to Hale Moore was the film We Were Soldiers, which I saw on opening night in 2002. It quickly became one of my favorite films, and to this day, it remains the best Vietnam War picture that I have ever seen. We Were Soldiers was also the first film I had seen to portray the Vietnam veteran in a positive light. For years, my generation had grown up on such fare as Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, The Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now, and Casualties of War, all of which portrayed the Vietnam veteran as either malicious or mentally unstable. We Were Soldiers, however, was an earnest and intimate portrayal of the men who answered their country's call of duty in Southeast Asia. In the years following the film's release, I read the books We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and We Are Soldiers Still. However, I was surprised to learn that no one had yet written a biography of Hale Moore himself. At the time I began researching this book, Moore was 88 years old and living quietly in Auburn, Alabama. We began our correspondence first through a series of letters and telephone interviews. Several months later, I had the opportunity to visit Hale Moore at his home, where he and I spent an entire week discussing his life and career. He graciously granted me access to his personal archives, which included a wealth of personal papers, photographs, government documents, war trophies, and We Were Soldiers memorabilia. During one of our initial interviews, Moore indicated that he had three younger siblings, Betty, Bill, and Ballard, all of whom were still living. All three siblings graciously gave me their time and readily shared memories of life with their elder brother. Moore's five children, Gregory, Stephen, Julie, Cecile, and David, supported me throughout every phase of this project. Aside from We Were Soldiers Once, and Young, and We Are Soldiers Still, other works produced by Moore include Building a Volunteer Army, The Fort Ord Contribution, 139-page monograph published by the Army Center of Military History. Building a Volunteer Army chronicles the early years of Project Volar and Moore's development of the training programs therein. The after-actions reports written by Moore give a detailed account of his unit's battles in the Yadrang Valley and Vong Son campaigns. Other primary sources included video footage from Moore's interviews at the Pritzker Military Library, Texas Tech University Vietnam Studies Center, and the American Veterans Center. I was fortunate that there was a wealth of secondary sources available for this project. Lawrence H. Johnson's seminal text, Winged Sabers, the Air Cavalry in Vietnam, is an authoritative account of the history of air cavalry and airmobile warfare. Air Mobility 1961 and 1971, published under the Vietnam Studies series at the Army Center of Military History, also provides a comprehensive study of American heliborne warfare. In Seven Firefights in Vietnam by John A. Cash, the entire first chapter is dedicated to the Battle of Yadrang, while Shelby Stanton's The First Cav in Vietnam, Anatomy of a Division, provided a detailed account of each brigade's operations throughout Vietnam. For contextual clarity, I also referenced E.M. Flanagan's The Angels, a history of the 11th Airborne Division. Although primarily a combat history, Flanagan's work also addresses the first year of the 11th Airborne's occupation duty in post-war Japan. This Kind of War by T.R. Fehrenbach is perhaps the most authoritative work on the politico-military dynamics of the Korean conflict. The United States Army in the Korean War series, another publication from the Army Center of Military History, was an indispensable resource in building my narrative for the hilltop battles of the Korean War. I give special thanks to Hal Moore and his children for their kindness and hospitality. Without their collective help, this book may never have been written. I would also like to thank the courteous and attentive staff at the Military History Institute, the American Veterans Center, and the Copyright Clearance Center for their assistance during my research. Special thanks to Bill Walls and Pike Conway, two of Moore's childhood friends who graciously shared their memories with me. Special thanks are also reserved for Colonel David Moore, USA retired, and his wife, Teresa Molinari Moore, for helping me coordinate my visit to Hal Moore's home in Alabama. Finally, I would like to thank the editorial and production team at Casemate Publishers for their patience and professional support. In a career which spanned over 30 years, Harold G. Moore proved himself to be a remarkable leader. This is his story, for he was a soldier once and always. Chapter 1. Early Years. The story of Harold Gregory Moore, Jr. begins in the foothills of southern Appalachia. Born on February 13, 1922, in Bardstown, Kentucky, Hale was the eldest of four children, born to Harold Sr. and Mary Moore, née Croom. At the time of Moore's birth, Bardstown was a small wisp of a community, with a population of less than 4,000. Nestled deep in the highlands of the Ohio River Valley, the rural Bardstown was a perfect place for Moore to feed his adventurous spirit. Like most boys growing up in small-town Kentucky, he immersed himself in the local variety of team sports, football, basketball, and baseball. His true childhood passion, however, was always the great outdoors. From an early age, he had a near-insatiable appetite for camping, hunting, and fishing. Very often, he would disappear into the woods behind his house, pitch a tent by his favorite fishing hole, and remain out there for days before returning home to show off his latest catch. Life in the Moore household revolved around three tenets: hard work, loyalty to the family, and devotion to the Catholic faith. The elder Moore was a strict, yet very loving father, Victorian in his principles, yet simple in his tastes. Every morning he would rise early to attend the 6 a.m. Mass at the Basilica of St. Joseph. And although he never finished high school, Harold Sr. was among the most respected insurance agents in western Kentucky. Mary was a homemaker and, by all accounts, the emotional bedrock of the family. She was a Methodist, but agreed to raise the children Catholic. Yet Harold and Mary's denominational differences never bothered them once. In fact, as Hal recalled, his mother was more Catholic in some of her ways, and she would go to church and light candles for our family all of her life. Throughout the Great Depression, the Moores fared better than most, for even during the hardest of economic times, Hal remembered that my father had good work, and we always had plenty to eat. Hal and his siblings also took part-time jobs within the community. I cut grass for a number of people, I caddied at the local golf course, and I worked Saturdays as a clerk at the local grocery store. And from an early age, the young Moore possessed a remarkable fascination with all things military. Indeed, when he wasn't riding his bicycle, casting lines at the local fishing hole, or taking care of his younger siblings, Betty, Bill, and Ballard, Moore could be found at the Bardstown Public Library, devouring any book he could find on military history. He particularly enjoyed reading about the great battlefield commanders of the American Revolution and the Civil War. From George Washington to Winfield Scott, these men embodied the same values which Moore sought to maintain in his own life. And by the dawn of his teenage years, Hal knew that he had found his calling. Aware of his son's enthusiasm for the military, Harold Sr. approached him with a suggestion that he apply to the United States Military Academy at West Point. It was 1937, and Hal was then a sophomore at St. Joseph's Preparatory School in Bardstown. The younger Moore was fascinated by West Point's legacy of leadership. Its graduates included many of the heroic leaders whom he had read about at the local library, including Ulysses S. Grant, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and John J. Pershing. Since its founding in 1802, West Point had been the nation's premier military academy and the primary source of commissioned officers for the U.S. Army. A rock-bound citadel ensconced on the banks of the Hudson River, West Point lay some 50 miles north of New York City. The school was renowned for its uncompromising standards of honor and discipline, and the Gothic architecture of the campus complemented its reputation as one of the most rigorous schools in America. Gaining admission to West Point, however, was no easy task. The applicant files read like a virtual who's who of America's best young scholars. Valedictorians, National Merit Scholars, and Eagle Scouts were among the many who sought to join the long gray line. Admission to the academy was further restricted by a congressional nomination process. A prospective cadet first had to obtain a nomination from his congressman or senator to be considered for admission. Moore certainly had the academic credentials, but he knew that his chances of receiving a nomination from the backwoods of Kentucky were slim to none. Opportunity knocked, however, on the afternoon of February 12, 1940. A 17-year-old Hal Moore was lying bedridden with pneumonia when his father came home with exciting news. Coming into the bedroom where Mary was tending to her ill son, the elder Moore wasted no time. Hal recalled that the local representative of U.S. Senator A.B. Happy Chandler had informed Dad that the senator had a patronage job opening in the Senate Book Warehouse in Washington, and it was mine if I wanted it. The pay was a mere $30 per week, $485.71 in 2012 dollars. But to a 17-year-old boy in 1940, it was an enviable sum. His father needed an answer immediately, and if Hal accepted the job, he would be on the next train to Washington, D.C. Hal realized that this may have been his only chance to gain an appointment. However, he still needed to finish high school. He was currently in his last semester at St. Joseph's, and only a few credits shy of graduation. But Moore's father, always one step ahead, had already spoken to the school's principal. It turned out that the principal agreed to let Hal graduate in June if he could finish the remaining credits at another school in Washington. The following morning, on Hal's 18th birthday, he and his father left Bardstown on the 5 a.m. train. "We spent the night in West Virginia and reached Washington, D.C. on February 14th in the afternoon," Moore said. Arriving in Washington, Moore rented a room from an elderly couple, enrolled at a local night school, and made an appointment with the nearest doctor to treat his lingering pneumonia. The following day, he reported to the Senate Book Warehouse. His job consisted mostly of clerical tasks, inventorying, stocking, and shipping various titles. Mundane and repetitive as it was, Moore still embraced his job with a delightful enthusiasm. Every day he rose from his bed in the hopes that he would find a congressman or senator with an unfilled appointment to his dream school. "Every month I pored over the list from the War Department of unfilled West Point appointments and went knocking on the doors of senators and congressmen on Capitol Hill, trying to persuade one of them to give me that appointment, Moore said. I had no luck in the beginning, but I kept studying that list and walking the halls of Congress. Trolling the halls of Congress by day, Moore finished his high school credits for algebra and English by night. That June, he returned to Bardstown to walk across the stage with his graduating class at St. Joseph's. Although he had not yet received an appointment to the academy, Moore vowed to remain in Washington until he did. In the meantime, he continued to work at the Senate Book Warehouse and enrolled at George Washington University. Moving out of his rented room, he pledged his membership to the Kappa Sigma fraternity and became their house manager in the fall of 1940. All the while, Moore continued his quest for a nomination to West Point. Ironically, his fortunes changed on December 7, 1941. Early that morning, the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. I was shocked like everyone else in America, Moore said. Prior to the attack, nearly everyone had considered Japan's military an inferior force. No one had anticipated a first strike against Hawaii, much less from the Japanese. The following day, the U.S. declared war on the Axis powers, and President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed legislation granting every senator and representative an additional appointment to both the military and naval academies. Sensing an opportunity, Hale went to Senator Chandler's office, brimming with hope that the new manpower needs would secure his nomination. Unfortunately, the senator had already given his last slot to another young man. Undeterred, Moore went to see his local congressman, Representative Ed Creel, 4th District, Kentucky. Creel sheepishly told him that he, too, had just given away his last slot. Creel did, however, have an open appointment to the U.S. Naval Academy and offered it to Moore. Although Moore had no desire to go to Annapolis, he thanked Creel for the appointment. But suddenly Moore had an idea. What if I can find another congressman who would appoint me to West Point in exchange for Representative Creel's Naval Academy appointment? Creel was surprised by the young Moore's proposal, but agreed to it, if Hale could find a congressman willing to make the swap. Hale soon found his way into the office of Congressman Eugene E. Cox, representing the 2nd District of Georgia. I walked into his office and I was greeted by his secretary, a Mrs. J.C. Robinson, Moore recalled. She showed me into his office and I asked the congressman if he would swap my Naval Academy appointment. Impressed by the young man's tenacity, Moore left that day with an appointment from the 2nd District of Georgia. In the summer of 1942, the new cadets arrived at West Point in two waves. The first contingent arrived on July 1st, the second on July 15th, making Moore's class the largest in West Point's young history. The cadets' first day was called Reception Day, or R-Day. It marked the beginning of a strenuous indoctrination known as Cadet Basic Training, or Beast Barracks, as it was commonly known. Although exclusively for West Point cadets, Beast Barracks largely resembled the basic training program of the regular Army. Most West Point graduates remember their R-Day as a blur of savage put-downs, dreadful stares, close calls with heat exhaustion, and the constant reminder that I wanted to come to West Point. For Hale Moore, R-Day certainly lived up to its chaotic reputation. He arrived at the academy with the second wave of incoming cadets on July 15, 1942. Scurrying off the train at the West Point Depot, Moore disembarked with nearly 500 other new cadets, all eager to begin their journey into officership. His classmates came from all over the country, most of them from small towns, which he had never heard of. Maxwell, Texas, Copley, Ohio, and Florence, Alabama, among others. They represented nearly every walk of life. Some were fresh out of high school, while others, like Moore, had a few years of college under their belts. Some had given up trade careers in carpentry, machinery, and electrical work to try their hand at soldiering. Others had been enlisted men who traded their chevrons for Cadet Gray. Whatever their background, they all came with the aspiration to become officers and fight the Axis powers. Hale never forgot the first non-commissioned officer he met on our day. When my group of soon-to-be cadets pulled into the train station, we were met by a stone-faced, spit-shined sergeant with a pencil-thin mustache, resplendent in cavalry hat, cavalry riding boots, and bloused riding breeches. His look implied that he had measured us, just as he had measured thousands like us before, and we did not for an instant impress him. His name fit him as well as those gleaming cavalry riding boots. Master Sergeant Bonebreak. We fell into something like a formation, and Bonebreak marched us up the hill and into the complex of imposing gray granite buildings brooding on the slopes and plain high above the Hudson River. There was a sense of ageless permanence, a majesty, if you will, about that place, and a cold, powerful, unbending, relentless, no-nonsense authority. Master Sergeant Bonebreak fit in perfectly with the place and the weight of its history and those thick gray granite walls. Every summer during Beast Barracks, the junior and senior year cadets assumed the role of drill sergeants, instructing the new cadets in military matters. When Bonebreak handed off more to his cadet instructors, the strenuous journey of Beast Barracks began. All at once, Hale's new name was Mister.
Get those shoulders back, Mister!
Hey, Mister, quit looking around!
What do you think you're doing, Mister?
Mister!
Then came the seemingly endless drill and marching commands.
Attention! Left face, right face, forward march, head east.
And very little of the latter. Soon thereafter, Moore would learn the sacred four responses, which every new cadet had to use whenever he was addressed by an upperclassman. A new cadet's responses were limited to, yes, sir, no, sir, no excuse, sir, and sir, I do not understand. After the crash course in military honorifics and close-order drill, Moore and his comrades were hoarded into the mess hall. Seated 10 to a table, Moore and the other new arrivals had to sit in a rigid posture of attention. Except for giving or receiving food, they were not allowed to look anywhere except for their plate. They could lift their utensils to their mouths only at a 90-degree angle and were limited to 3 chews per bite. At the head of the table sat a senior-year cadet known as the table commandant. His job, as far as Moore was concerned, was to make the meal miserable for every new cadet at his table. The table commandants were notorious for scrutinizing their younger cadets' every move, anxiously awaiting the chance to correct any breach of table etiquette. Moore soon discovered that the cadets were not referred to as freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. Instead, they were referred to, respectively, as fourth class, third class, second class, and first class cadets. Traditionally, the fourth classmen were known as plebes, a derivative of the word plebeian, referring to the lowest class of Roman society. Third classmen were called yearlings, a term used to describe a year-old farm animal. The second classmen were cows, but the origin of that term remains in obscurity. The most likely explanation was that, in years past, the cadets had no leave until after yearling year. Thus, when the rising second classmen returned from their summer furlough, it was heralded as the cows coming home. The first classman's nickname was merely an abbreviation, Firstie. Throughout Beast Barracks, Moore learned the fundamentals of soldiering. Rifle marksmanship, patrolling, hand grenades, and the proper technique of shining shoes. By August, we had been to the firing range, run the obstacle course, taken the physical efficiency tests, learned to prepare a 40-pound pack with bedroll, and demonstrated skill in hand-to-hand combat. Moore remembered that the high point for him during Beast Barracks was firing expert on the M1 rifle with the top score in the company and being given a pint of vanilla ice cream by my squad leader. Also early on in Beast Barracks, I discovered a safe haven, the Catholic Rectory. I was a frequent visitor there and attended Mass often. Hal often said that his religious beliefs were his greatest source of strength during those tough times. He formed a close friendship with the rector, Monsignor George Murdoch, and the two often prayed together. Whenever his schedule permitted, Hal would slip away to the sanctuary for daily Mass. Beast Barracks culminated with the so-called plebe maneuvers at Pine Camp, present-day Fort Drum near Watertown, New York. It was a week-long field exercise which introduced plebes to the art of bivouacking and how to maneuver at the squad and platoon level. Upon their return to West Point, we regrouped into new companies formed as the corps grew from 1 to 2 regiments to accommodate our large class. Moore found himself assigned to Company C1, C Company, 1st Regiment. Beast Barracks had come to an end. It was time to start the academic year. Although Moore excelled in English and history, he admitted, "I was so dumb in mathematics, particularly algebra, differential equations, and solid geometry, but I managed through." By October, he recalled that my name was on the list of cadets severely deficient in grades and solid geometry and advanced algebra, meaning that he was in danger of flunking out if his grades did not improve. Fearful of losing what he had worked so hard to achieve, Hale said that I was glued to my advanced math textbooks every night from 7:30 p.m. until lights out at 11 p.m. And after lights out, I moved to the nearby restroom down the hall from my room, where Moore sat on a toilet studying by the dim light of a 40-watt bulb. Plowing through his textbooks until 1 or 2 in the morning, Hale knew that even if I didn't understand the advanced, arcane math and bewildering engineering, physics, and chemistry, I could at least memorize the procedures. As if the academics weren't trying enough, Moore also had to adjust to the rigors of plebe life. Every day brought a new trial as the upperclassmen, invoking some contrived rite of passage, would harass Moore by making him recite the various topics of plebe knowledge. The so-called plebe knowledge was a collection of facts and folklore about West Point, which every plebe had to memorize and be ready to recite at any given moment. It covered a variety of topics, some of which were useful, the technical specifications of an M1 rifle, while others were downright trivial, the number of gallons in nearby Lusk Reservoir. We found the world of a plebe to be one of survival. Once we could spout off the mandatory plebe knowledge, recite all the particular items given to us by upperclassmen, and along the way provide a new joke, we usually stayed out of trouble. One facet of the plebe system that Moore didn't mind, however, was a daily recitation from the New York Times. The newspaper was delivered to the cadets every morning, and a plebe was often required to recite the day's headlines for the upperclassmen. This gave Moore a chance to read about what was happening on the front lines in Europe and the Pacific. After some initial setbacks in North Africa, Moore was glad to hear that the Allied forces were once again on the offensive. In the Pacific, the U.S. Navy had won a decisive victory at Midway, and the Army Air Forces were pounding away at the Solomon Islands. The stories that interested him the most, however, were the ones discussing a new type of warfare, airborne infantry. During World War II, American airborne forces fell into two categories, parachute infantry and glider infantry. Parachute infantry, as the name implied, delivered troops into battle via parachute. Military equipment, including rations, radios, and even jeeps, could also be fitted with parachutes for insertion into a combat zone. Glider infantry, on the other hand, placed troops into a 13-man glider, which would fly behind the tether of a towing aircraft. Once the glider reached its designated landing zone, or LZ, it would detach from the tether and sail to the ground. That fall, Hale and his classmates received some unexpected good news. The Academy's curriculum had been accelerated to 3 years instead of 4. No longer were we the class of 1946. We were now the new class of 1945. Rumors abounded that the curriculum might be accelerated even further, perhaps to as little as 18 months, as it had been during World War I. However, nothing came of it. Moore later discovered that even though the curriculum had been shortened by a year, the total hours of instruction actually increased. To accommodate the new course acceleration, West Point graduated 2 classes in 1943. The original class of 1943 accelerated to become the class of January 1943, while the previous class of 1944 became the class of June 1943. Hale Moore made it through plebe year by the skin of his teeth. It was, as he called it, an academic trip from hell. He survived his midterms and finals, but the distressing experience of struggling for weeks to get pro, that is, proficient, and stay pro, knowing the ominous results, if not, profoundly affected me. From then on, I led an unbalanced life at the academy, that is, few extracurricular activities and a lot of studying. Moore ended his plebe year with a 10-day furlough and a chance to get some much-needed rest. But before we knew it, we were back at West Point for a summer of military training at Camp Popolopen. By the summer of 1943, American and British forces had emerged victorious in North Africa and Sicily, while in the Pacific theater, our Allied forces had launched the long campaign back, starting with the seizure of Guadalcanal the previous fall. We were well aware that our military training was helping to prepare us to lead men somewhere in one of those theaters of war. We fired many weapons, learned to drive tanks and other military vehicles, and participated in maneuvers, culminating with the second trip to Pine Camp, where they had done plebe maneuvers the previous summer. Returning to West Point for another year of academics, Moore saw several of his classmates sign up for flight training. Before the U.S. Air Force became its own branch,
sample complete. Ready to continue?